shape the modern world, what do you define as a thinker?
Well, it's something we thought about a lot, the publisher, editor, myself, because people, in fact, someone just asked me, well, why don't you have Steve Jobs? Why don't you have Henry Ford? And the answer is because they are doers. The thinkers are defined really as people who have a body of work so large and probably so systematic that it couldn't be ignored. It's like a boulder in the intellectual landscape. You're going to bump into it. And you have to contend with it because it'll be a body of thought that had an enormous effect. So choosing 50 since Kant, you could say, might be difficult because there are so many, and I would argue there aren't so many. We probably had 150 or 200 names on the list. You know, people like Rachel Carson, you know, or C.L.R. James. But when it came down to that kind of definition, you know, I think we'd be hard-pressed to hit 60.
Really? So it's definitely the idea that it's a systematic, it's a complete body of work. There's no kind of gap.
Well, for instance, you know, someone like Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, completely important to the history of Western thought since Kant, you know, the forerunner, the mother of feminism, you could say. But On the Vindication of the Rights of Women and work by her has an enormous impact, but it's not a complete body of work. It's a stepping stone. It's an increment that leads then to Simone de Beauvoir, then leads to others. You know, so you have retrospectively defined first, second, and third waves of feminism. So someone like Mary Wollstonecraft is written about and incorporated in the article on de Beauvoir, as are some people who came after her. So each of the thinkers has probably another 10 or so thinkers mentioned inside the article who might have been affected by them or for whom they took inspiration and maybe argued against them and so pushed the thing forward.
One thing that I noticed is that most of them, if not all of them, are Anglo-European or Anglo-American or Spanish, some European. Are there no one from outside Europe in that? I imagine you're probably getting that a lot, so you probably have a good answer for it.
Well, when we sat down to do it, I'm going to take you back to when I edited the second and third editions of the Fontana Dictionary of Modern Thought with Lord Bullock. I looked at the first edition and I said, this is all Western thought. There's nothing really, the whole Eastern tradition, which is enormous, is absent from it. And I was told, well, that's for a reason. It would be twice as big. And I said, well, we could cut down some of what we've already got. We could edit it down and make room. And the answer was no, from the publishers. And I can sort of see why that is the case. I will tell you now that I wouldn't be qualified to undertake such a thing. And there is a book that precedes this that was published in February of this year by Atlantic called A Short History of Western Thought, in which I look very carefully at the Islamic tradition and actually how it saved the Western classical tradition for us. And it looks at the Jewish tradition, Maimonides, and so forth. But the when you say Eastern, I mean, or Oriental, it's like a world even bigger than the Western one, how big would that book be? And it certainly wouldn't be written by me, who knows very little about it.
Okay. Fair enough. I hear you were grilled a bit on Woman's Hour as well about... Was it Woman's Hour? About the lack of women, because there are three. And my throw out of there is like someone like Elizabeth Cady Stanton or even Grace Hopper.
Well,
my two mean questions.
Sure. Well, and I'm going to give you just a straight answer. Neither of those persons contributed a body of thought so large and so massively important as any of those people who are on the front cover of this book. These people are big chapters. They're the motorway. Mm-hmm. And people like that are B roads and some A roads. That's why.
Okay. So we'll expand out, because there's lots of interesting people, and you said there might be 60, or you had a list of 150. Who would have you liked to include who may not have fit your definition, but who's, you know, someone you think is really important to modern thought?
Well, you know, there's a group of people who I would put, you know, as A Rhodes, you know, like Rachel Carson. Mm-hmm. And I always feel, and I'm blanking on his name now because I feel so So sorry that I was, and I feel bad and probably wrong that I didn't include him, our greatest legal philosopher of the age, whose name escapes me now because I'm going to be punished for not putting him in. To be honest, it wasn't that difficult. And and actually, if someone had said to me, make it 30, I think I could have.
Cool. Well, I was going to ask about Auguste Comte because he kind of informs a lot of my research because he's given loads of short shrift in historical circles. So why is he important for us?
Well, one of the reasons why he is in there is I thought it important to elevate some people into, you know, second and third divisions, and also to drop some down. You know, Bertrand Russell, boom, demoted. Hannah Arendt, bang, up there in the Premier division. He is important because the methodological thing alone counts for enormous amount. So that someone who, I mean, Edmund Husserl, who I think is the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, the phenomenological method, it wouldn't even matter if he hadn't published his conclusions. The fact that he laid out a program of research that any of us can use, and many people did, Martin Heidegger, and better yet, Hannah Arendt, makes him very important. So I think Comte is important that way. That's an enormous contribution to give a method.
I liked at the end as well, you had this little bit about philosophy of science. And we interview loads of scientists and cover all that. And some of them really hate the idea of philosophy of science. So how do we bring them around? What's of interest to them to take?
I wouldn't bring them around. I'd fire them. Why would you want to bring them around? They're incomplete people.
Really?
It's a foolish, foolish way to behave, to exist extra-historically. Are you kidding me? It's a cardinal sin of thought.
Well, one example, I guess, for you bringing that up is Sam Harris's book, The Moral Landscape, which was heavily criticized because he just dismissed is ought and all that sort of stuff. Is that the kind of thing you're driving at?
No, I'm driving at Stephen Hawking, for instance, saying in his latest book that philosophy is dead. Are you kidding me? That is the silliest thing I've ever heard. I don't care how much physics he's done. It's silly and it's foolish and childish, because every philosopher from the pre-Socratics to the modern period really were scientists. They didn't have the tools yet that we have, like microscopes or telescopes or sophisticated measuring devices or even knowing what the structure of our world was. You know, Democritus knew about atoms, but he didn't know how complicated they were. Those people looked around them and tried to figure out, without a religious or other mythical explanation, what is this, first of all, and why? And so they were scientists. They were asking scientific questions, but only able to give, if you like, philosophical answers, because they didn't have experimental data, they didn't have mathematics, they didn't have logic, they didn't have a lot of things. As time moves along, the philosophical urge, the philosophical attitude becomes scientific. Newton is a thinker, but he's actually able to figure out actually the basic, the principle of gravity, which is then considered a scientific pursuit. But it's hard to think of any aspect of applied science and technology that does not have a philosophical component about its use.
Do you distinguish between, like, philosophy and ethics, or are they just kind of combined?
Ethics is one of the branches of philosophy. Right. It is. But, you know, if we think about the enormous scientific discoveries that lead to technological breakthroughs, the human genome, for instance, which gives us technologies which raise all kinds of ethical issues. If I give you a genetic test as an infant and it shows you're predisposed to heart disease and we're in America, I'm not going to insure you because you have a pre-existing condition. Are you kidding me? It's evil.
So I had my favorites in this book, and I was trying to think, out of the 50, who do you think, who is the most important? My random guess would be someone like Karl Marx, because they defined a lot of the 20th century and things like that. Who do you think, out of the 50, is probably the person that has influenced us the most?
Well, I would put the three of Marx, Darwin, and Freud, simply because each of them mapped aspects of who we are and where we are. Marx defined our social and economic relations, and Charles Darwin described, you know, how we got here and possibly where we are going. And Freud goes inside us to chart the topography of the psyche, which had previously been unexplored. So all three of them provide a map. But let's leave them aside as very, very, very important. I think Husserl, just because of his methodological attitude and his way of doing philosophy, is the greatest. And two of the people he influenced are among the greatest. You could say, that as many people have, that Martin Heidegger is the greatest philosopher of the 20th century. Well, I could say he's the greatest Nazi philosopher of the 20th century. What I would say is that Heidegger's pupil and lover, Hannah Arendt, is actually one of the most underrated and really terrific philosophers of the 20th century. She reinvented political philosophy for the modern period. And in her book, her first book, On the Origins of Totalitarianism, within, you know, 6 years of the end of World War II, she described exactly how it came to be, fascism, communism, and working backwards from the pogroms in the East. And she laid out a way of understanding modern political formations and what the duties and rights of citizens were, or are, that to me is so important. And I know her books are in print, but she seems to be more purchased than read, because you don't hear her discussed very much. But I would take her from the third division where she languished and put her in the top 10.
I guess one of the criticisms you could get is that some people might see how some of these people have influenced, like Darwin and Marx and things like that, but others, it's hard to see in the modern street that people would see how it would influence them. So how do you take these ideas and how are they applicable to someone watching X Factor?
It's when you look at someone like Frege or Russell, who work in an area of mathematics and logic that is so advanced that most of us, I mean 99% of us, have no idea what they're doing. I don't. Yet, it's very important because it changed the course of philosophical history. Britain, Hegelianism, was the prevailing philosophy of the United Kingdom until the middle of the 19th century, right up until the beginning of the 20th. And together, G.E. Moore and Russell decided to kill it. And they did. They very successfully, within a matter of years, cleaned Hegel out of the universities and replaced them with analytic philosophers, a condition which exists today in 2012. So that's enormously important. Now, the fact that we can't understand, most of us, what Russell did mathematically matters little against what he did, but it's kind of a technical achievement. Now, in my competitor, Bertrand Russell, in his history of philosophy, denigrates his contemporary Henri Bergson, who is another one that I would bring, if not into the Premier League, into the First Division, because he was a wonderful popularizer of complicated metaphysical ideas. And even in translation, he reads so beautifully. And he could explain his thinking to anyone. Anyone with half a mind can understand what he's saying. And I think that ought to be a goal of philosophy, to be useful in the sense that it may be highfalutin serious thinking, but that I can tell you what it is, you can see what I mean, and then decide whether that has some relevance for you or not, and possibly may influence the way you think about things, the moral choices you may make. But it's nowadays, most philosophy is written for academic advancement. It's papers written by philosophers for other philosophers so that they can get tenure or keep it. And the subject matter is not of interest to the ordinary person. Now, some philosophy can't be. I mean, their modal logic is modal logic, and I don't think you can probably make it sexy. But I think philosophy has to maintain a relevance to our lives because we are guided by thought. We should think ourselves, and when we see models of good thinking from other people who have encountered the same problems, we learn from that, and perhaps we become philosophers ourselves and move it forward a little bit more.
So another interesting thing that you mentioned in the book is that you probably don't think there's any more superstars in philosophy. Do you think we're just too close to our present to actually see someone? Will it take 50 years, 100 years?
That's exactly what I think. I think that to be a superstar in your own time, well, look, in the middle of the 20th century, it happened. Both de Beauvoir and Sartre were superstars, still are. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think of philosophers, if you ask people at the bus stop who are philosophers, they might think of Jean-Paul Sartre. A.J. Ayer probably was the last one in this country that, you know, everyone would know of, and, you know, whose Language, Truth, and Logic sold millions of copies. It's still in print. Nowadays, it's hard to think of who could be in a position like Sartre, de Beauvoir, or A.J. Ayer in this country, partly because the work of contemporary philosophers is very technical, and often it is completing problems set by previous thinkers. The Cambridge philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe, you know, a very clever philosopher and good ethicist, but she was Wittgenstein's pupil. And Wittgenstein trusted her with all of his texts. And you probably know that he scribbled hundreds of pages of notebook, but it wasn't ever an organized book. The work had to be edited, translated, and he trusted her. And so an awful lot of her working life, the actual time of it, was taken with doing this incredibly difficult and necessary task. It's to her we owe coherent texts, because Wittgenstein only published one book in his lifetime. Now there's a shelf full of them because of her. So it didn't give her much time to do whatever it is she might have done if she'd chosen not to accept that job. The American woman, Susan Hack, a devotee of C.S. Peirce, again, she takes his work and finishes it or keeps it moving forward. So she's thought of as a Peircean, and she's a terrific philosopher, but your man in the street isn't going to know who she is doing her technical job. I think in the biological sciences you have, you know, someone like Dawkins, who makes big, bold statements about things and is able to write books that are pretty accessible to, you know, the general reading public. So he becomes a sort of... Hawkins is a superstar. Neither of them are philosophers, but both of them deal with philosophical material. Mm-hmm. Stephen Hawking is a philosopher who simply doesn't have the courage of acknowledging what he is.
At the end of the book, there's this litany of things that are kind of against the idea that philosophy is dead. What do you think are going to be the ones that grip us the most, the ones that we're going to be trying to answer from, you know, for the next 50 years?
All of the Western democracies face incredible challenges from terrorism. And how a civilized and balanced society responds to that kind of irrational violence, which is the product of unreason, I think judges will be judged by that response. Now, you have to do something. You can't just let it be. But how much of our own humanity are we willing to sacrifice to stop Al-Qaeda, for instance, which by its very definition is pretty unstoppable as a kind of virus that spreads with hit-and-run tactics and, you know, a cellular structure that is unlikely to be penetrated by the CIA anytime soon or ever. So it really requires, if you ask me, people in government able to think philosophically, to be able to think ethically, to be able to think in the tradition of political philosophy, what do we do? And before the Air Force is called in again, I think it would be a good idea if philosophers were asked to sit at the table, because these sort of problems are the type of problems that they're used to. The particularity is just the particularity of them. So that is one area. Another area is really in the realm of ethics, to do with new technologies that have resulted from scientific breakthroughs, anywhere from, you know, right-to-life issues to things like the Human Genome Project, genetic engineering. The thing of assisted suicide is really, it's a nagging and important subject everywhere in the West. And the arguments for and against are cogent and more or less convincing, depending on who's making them. They have the problem of being tied up inside religious practice as well as just common sense and intellectual reason. So they are always with us. They're always problematic. And they raise real issues of self-determination. Never mind, do we allow religion to control our lives and make decisions, but how much are we going to allow another person, a doctor, for instance, to make those decisions, or a legislator? And there are many, many people in terrible pain towards the end of their life, and you may well ask the question, why must they not be allowed to end their suffering or be obliged to be a morphine addict, slowly dying? I mean, these are really big questions, and they cannot be answered by technology. The technology already exists. The technology is why we're asking the question. So ethics is required, and we are all of us called upon to be ethicists. So I suggest we all get reading before we die.
And maybe a tricky question for you. Everyone, you probably have your favorite philosopher who you could have included, but was there someone you really dislike but is on this list?
Bertrand Russell.
You really dislike Bertrand Russell?
Horrible man.
Well, he was quite an interesting personal life.
He's an absolute bastard. He's anti-Semite, he's racist. He's one of the most unpleasant people you could hope to meet.
That's amazing. And to end on a slightly better note, who's your favorite?
I would want to be on a desert island with Schopenhauer.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. That was possibly the most enlightening interview we've had on the podcast. So, yes.
And we'll put links to find out all about the book and buy it and all that on the Podsolution website.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.